Thanks, Bill. So I wanted to start by sort of apologizing for the end last time. I think things got a little fast. I was nervous. I had a lot of material to cover. So I'm going to try to first just say some really schematic things about what's going on, and then maybe revisit what we did last time. And then maybe depending on how people are feeling, we'll either kind of do some more detailed stuff, or maybe I'll just say some more fun stuff. We can just figure it out. So, so I'm going to start with this sort of slogan. So all week we've been talking about kind of quantum field theories over manifolds M. And what we sort of learned is that these were sort of factorization BD0 algebras over M. And the sort of main construction we did, we sort of learned this construction where to each open set U, we associated sort of functions on sort of the fields on U adjoin H bar. And then we had this differential that was sort of like Poisson bracket with S plus H bar times this kind of BV Laplacian. This was sort of the main thing that we learned, I think, in kind of Kevin and Phil's lectures. Okay, so an important sort of precursor to this was that we sort of had classical field theory over M. And this was sort of explained in terms of sort of factorization P0 algebras. And Kevin, in his maybe most recent talk, kind of nicely explained how things like Poisson vertex algebras are kind of related to this sort of thing. It's basically the same data. And here there was an analogous kind of construction where we set U to sort of just functions on E of U with this differential given by Poisson bracket with S. And in particular, we had this Poisson bracket, which gave us this P0 structure. Okay. And now I just wanted to point out, like, when we talk about having this BD0 algebra, we really have this kind of like family of guys over H bar. And we can sort of just set H bar to zero. And we can go back here. So in a way, this is like slightly more data than just QFT. Let me say it's sort of like both classical and quantum, sort of with the quantization. That's sort of more what this factorization BD0 is describing. It's the sort of full data. In particular, you can kind of specialize to H bar equals zero and go back here. And you could also do something where you kind of like specialize to H bar equals one. You can't sort of necessarily literally do that. You can sort of formally pass to the sort of generic fiber here. And roughly speaking, like what I just want to sort of say, there's this sort of kind of point of this BD0 thing is that when you pass to the generic fiber, you just get what's called an E0 algebra, which is just kind of a fancy word basically for a vector space. So actual quantum field theory is basically described by these factorization E0 algebras. And the point is, like, in the concrete calculations, we saw that, like, understanding just the vector space that's being assigned to every open set and the structure maps as maps of vector spaces, or like cochain complexes, DG vector spaces, but just as vector spaces without all this other data, it was enough to recover this thing, like this associative algebra product in the one-dimensional topological case and so on. And we didn't really need, like, we didn't really exploit this full BD0 thing that often. So just some comments there.
So you're saying a quantum field theory on M is just a factorization E0 algebra.
Yeah, AKA just factorization algebra full stop, like the definition Kevin gave in the beginning, where you're just assigning cochain complexes to each open set. E0 is like a fancy word for vector. I just
if this were a topological field theory, then the factorization algebra would be locally constant.
Yeah.
So we need EN E0 algebra.
Which,
right?
By additivity, is just an EN algebra. But that is right. And in fact, I was about to talk about that. But maybe I'll just, let me just make one more remark, which is this passage from sort of P0 to E0 which seems sort of maybe a little funny or something, is sort of analogous. And in fact, there's a precise sense in which this is true. There's this kind of really nice theorem of Nick Rosenblum kind of about this sort of thing, analogous to the situation, which is much more familiar, of filtered quantization, where you have a P1 algebra, which is an honest Poisson algebra, and it deforms to an E1 algebra, which is basically like an associative algebra, in case you don't remember. So I just wanted to sort of say, like, somehow you should think of this as some version. So one more kind of slogan. I think you kind of learned this maybe already, but so topological field theory, as Ben kindly just reminded us, over M, was described by a locally constant. Factorization algebra over M. And when M was Rn, this is equivalent, the above is equivalent to what's called an En algebra. And Kevin kind of explained, I think, pretty slowly that, like, whatever this thing kind of is, you have, it tells you how to associate to a picture like this, where you include two intervals into a bigger interval, a map where you sort of assign each of these intervals kind of a copy of A, so a map from A tensor A to A. And this was the associative multiplication map of the kind of associative algebra. So I mentioned in the one-dimensional case, E1 algebras are associative algebras. That was what was going on. And then somehow in general, you should picture that for any kind of choice of sort of disks inside some bigger disk, you're getting some kind of topological OPE. I'm not going to say more about that, but I just wanted to recall that kind of slogan. Great. So now from this more schematic perspective, I just want to talk again about what's going to happen when you have a manifold with boundary. And I think Davide kind of explained a little bit about what the expectation is here, but I just wanted to kind of reiterate. So let's start in one dimension. So on R greater than or equal to zero, let's consider a locally constant factorization algebra. And so what's going to happen, this is sort of zero here. Maybe I should be R less than or equal to zero, whatever. So away from the boundary, we're just in the exact same situation as before. We can kind of have these open intervals. And we're getting, again, an associative algebra. But now, we can also consider intervals that intersect the boundary, sort of half-closed intervals. They're, you know, open here in the subspace topology, whatever. You're allowed to choose those. And we're going to assign something different to them. And if you notice that we have a structure map coming from the inclusion of this open interval and this half-open one into a bigger half-open one, which would also get assigned M, we get a map like this, and the kind of associativity condition coming from including multiple intervals here tells us that this map, rho, is an A module structure on. So our conclusion is that on manifolds with boundary, in the one-dimensional case, we find at the boundary a module for this kind of algebra that we found in the bulk.
Maybe H for Hilbert space would be good. Okay. We've already used M.
What was M? Oh, my manifold. That's a great point. I guess I'll go with H. Sure, thanks.
No module is really tempting, though.
Yeah, I'm kind of an M for modules guy, but you know, whatever. I'll probably keep writing M. You can help me. And then I just want to point out, like, without sort of maybe going into too much detail about it, like, let's just get an idea of kind of what might happen in general, like in kind of higher dimensions. So first I'm going to draw a picture, and then I'm going to try to formalize it. So the picture is as follows, that, you know, we'll have some sort of bulk manifold here, and its boundary is here. And now, sort of out here, we'll have our usual pictures with our open sets, sort of like there. But we'll have these kind of half intervals on the boundary, which are kind of analogous, to which we'll assign something analogous to this module. And we'll have still some kind of module-type structure, but somehow it needs to be compatible with this sort of multi-direction topological OPE map that we have in the bulk here. And in particular, if we just isolate the behavior along the boundary, we have just inclusions of sort of two half disks into a bigger half disk, which if we focus on the boundary, it's sort of like the inclusion of two sort of intervals into a bigger interval. So in particular, part of the data is a sort of factorization algebra on the boundary. So here, sort of, let's say M was sort of R less than or equal to 0 times N. And our conclusion is that part of the data is a factorization algebra on this boundary map. So to try to make some slightly more precise statements about this, I want to make a simplifying assumption, which is I want to restrict my attention to field theories, which are topological, kind of in the direction normal to the boundary. So the way I'm going to describe this, it's kind of funny. I'm going to claim that sort of I can consider something. So M is, again, of this form, R less than or equal to 0 times N. And I'll consider sort of factorization E1 algebras over this boundary manifold N. And the claim I'm going to make is that these include into all factorization algebras on M. So how should you think about this? There's sort of a factorization in the n direction, and then for any kind of open interval kind of in the n direction, if you kind of look at the tube over it, you also know some kind of E1 structure coming from sort of including two disks into a bigger disk. And when you sort of coherently put it all together, that's a special case of a factorization algebra on the whole M.
You're secretly using some kind of additivity.
Yeah, so this, I'm sort of cheating. I'm trying to avoid saying something about like down additivity, but that's totally the idea here. But concretely, it's something about, you know, like the product topology being generated by boxes. There's like, you know, I'm not saying anything crazy. I'm just sort of saying if you know how to do this, then you sort of in particular know how to do this. And this kind of really isolates this idea of it being topological in one direction. So in terms of this, I now want to tell you sort of what this thing on the boundary is. So we learned in this sort of one-dimensional example, we had sort of an E1 algebra in the bulk, and we had a module for it. Or like maybe remembering that we have this fancy word E0 for sort of vector spaces, we had kind of an E1 algebra and an E0 algebra that it acted on. So here I'm just going to kind of formally sort of replace this. I'm going to sort of say, like, what should we expect in this boundary setup? We should expect to have A, analogous to the bulk A there, a factorization E1 algebra, and we should have H, nice, I did it, a sort of factorization E0 algebra over N. So in particular, we said this is like a normal factorization algebra, factorization E0, and so we find that indeed part of the data is just a factorization algebra along the boundary. So I just tried, I basically kind of gave, it seems a little funky, but I gave just a formalization of this kind of intuition about what I drew here. Yeah.
So like along the boundary is the E1.
No, sort of normal to the boundary is the E1. The, somehow here N is of any dimension, R is one dimensional. Yeah.
So H is the boundary theory and A is the bulk theory.
That's right.
For this
bulk
space.
For this, that's absolutely right.
Can you like functional cohomology acting on algebra?
Yeah, I think if Hochschild cohomology was like a more familiar thing for more people, I might have said more ENE things, but I'm not going to do that. Yeah, tutor.
Do you ever want to say you have a map from one into the other? Like the action is internal in some sense.
Yeah, so I'm going to focus actually just in a second on the classical case, and there that will sort of definitely be true. You know, so if you just take this case where n is a point, then I sort of, you know, I ask you, like, what is your map from an algebra to the module that sort of tells you what the action is? It's not quite, but I mean, what Sam was pointing out is you can say it's a map to sort of, in your module case, you'd say it's a map to the endomorphisms of the module. And in general, you would sort of say, oh, it's a map to like the Hochschild cochains on the EN minus one algebra, which is in fact an EN algebra. And maybe that's kind of the flavor of thinking about. Yeah. Yeah, that's actually true. That's fair. So Sam kind of correctly points out that E0, in addition to sort of just being a fancy word, means it's a pointed vector space. And so you can kind of act on the pointing. That's sort of like your vacuum or whatever. But let me go on. So I didn't quite leave myself enough room here, but I'm going to squeeze it in. You'll have to forgive me. Ben can remind me to lift the board after. What is the classical version of this story? So we sort of learned how to translate kind of here. We sort of learned that sort of E0 classically is P0 and E1 classically is P1. So somehow what we should expect classically is a factorization P1 algebra over N, a factorization P0 algebra over N, and an action. But in this case, because these things are sort of really commutative, you know, modules over, when one commutative algebra acts on another, then it really is coming from a map of commutative algebras. So we expect a map, an honest map here. And it's going to turn out, this is sort of a hard thing to explain without appealing to sort of this sort of more operatic perspective using these EN algebras, but it turns out that the kind of right notion of a map here is that this map be Lagrangian. So notice this is sort of a map at the level of functions. I'll sort of say more about this in a second, but geometrically you should think the map is going this way, and this guy is going to kind of be a Lagrangian.
Why is the map, like why do you expect that
kind of map? I was just saying like when you have a commutative algebra, which is a module over another commutative algebra, that sort of structure comes from an actual. Yeah. So of course, like, again, the picture here is sort of these factorization P1 algebras on N are somehow sitting inside of factorization P0 algebras over this full M. That's this one. So I'm going to kind of go into more detail here. I mean, there is just a definition of a Lagrangian map from a P1 to P0 algebra.
We just have to
poison.
Lagrangian is usually a symplectic
group. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, sorry. You correctly point out, yeah. So in practice, this P1 guy will sort of really be actually zero symplectic, and then you'll really know. Yeah, no, that's a totally good point. I'm going to sort of go back to something kind of a more concrete example in just a second. Great. Okay. So now that I have like a little bit of a more kind of formal perspective built up, I just want to revisit what we talked about last time. This boundary theory construction. And hopefully it will seem a little more kind of reasonable this second time around, having this kind of our expectations a little bit more clearly stated. So, as I said in the beginning, we've sort of been learning about constructing these factorization P0 algebras, the sort of guys in that corner over there, sort of the whole time, sort of from these E's. So we have some kind of E, and it's supposed to give rise to a factorization P0 algebra in the way that I just have right up there. So now this kind of assumption about being topological normal to the boundary, how is that going to be manifested in this case? It's going to be manifested by E being of the form kind of, so it's some space of fields, it's like a vector bundle over, or a complex of vector bundles over this manifold like R cross N, and it's going to be of the form kind of Durham forms on R less than or equal to zero, exterior product, some other space of fields in the kind of direction along the boundary. So as a concrete example, like let's say we had kind of, so here M equals, again, was R greater than or equal to zero times N. And in the case, let's just do an example where N is sort of a Riemann surface sigma. If we put sort of Chern-Simons on this three manifold, we'd have kind of forms on M, tensor G, and we could write this just as forms on R, exterior, forms on sigma, tensor G. And this is our. And we in fact saw last time that whatever kind of integration pairing we had on here that made it formally minus one shifted, we'll find, sort of functions on E del is P1 factorization. Over M. And of course, like if we know this, we can recover E by just tacking on this extra copy of forms. And so we really see this kind of inclusion that I wrote up here in this concrete way. We have this factorization P1 guy over the boundary, and just tacking on this forms in the normal direction kind of includes it into this sort of space of all theories that we were considering before. Well, basically, the integration pairing gets an extra shift. It's sort of related to the dimension of the source from this like AKSZ counting.
Should that be omega dot of R greater than or R less than?
Yes, yes, sorry, yeah.
To get the P0 thing on the Chern-Simons, you have to take the one on the boundary and like transgress it.
There's nothing fancy about transgressing. It's just like taking an exterior product. It's like, okay, so what was the Chern-Simons pairing? You like wedge the forms, and you integrate. If you decompose the space of forms this way, you kind of like wedged here, and you wedged here, and you paired this, and you integrated. Like, the pairing here, I claim, sort of obviously breaks up into sort of the integration pairing here, exterior product, the like another pairing here, and the shift is just off by one. Maybe it will be also helpful for me to write. This is sort of like maps M to BG, and M is a product, so I can use this kind of, and think of this as maps from R to maps sigma to BG. And then this AKSZ counting just makes it totally apparent that this is sort of, this guy has one less shift, and then sort of it's, as a result, zero shifted, and then mapping into it gives a minus one shifted. But it's kind of totally trivial from the like concrete pairings that you're writing.
Can you just say again, what was I supposed to take, or you can raise the board? What was I supposed to take from this board?
That the notion of a theory being topological in the normal direction at the classical level is just this assumption that E splits in this way. And in such a case, we find that in perfect analogy with our construction of a factorization P0 algebra from a classical field theory, we find a factorization P1 algebra on the boundary, and that this inclusion is realized by just remembering that we can always tack on this extra forms direction.
To be pedantic, the maps are less than or equal to zero.
Yeah, I'm going to keep missing that, but thanks, I appreciate it. Okay, great. So now we're in this position. We know, we have this kind of schematic expectation that we derive from kind of thinking about this 1D case and translating into the classical picture. And so we know exactly what we expect. We expect that the condition, the sort of data of this boundary condition, in terms of like once we've made this topological normal to the boundary assumption, it's somehow going to be manifested in having some kind of factorization P0 algebra on the boundary and some kind of Lagrangian map.
Wait, what are you trying to you're trying to tell us now what a boundary condition is in the quantum theory?
No, I mean, I was focusing on this lower half of the board, so everything here is classical. I was trying to tell you.
I mean, you just explained to us what it means to be topological normal to the boundary classical.
In the kind of perturbative setting, but I also explained here more kind of schematically what you should expect a boundary condition should be. The sort of punchline was a boundary condition here was a factorization P0 algebra on the boundary and a Lagrangian map to it. And so now I'm going to try to just spell that out in this kind of more concrete setting. So that's our abstract expectation. We're able to realize kind of the top row there in the classical world, as I just explained. And now we know like somehow what we're supposed to do. Like from physics, we like know we're supposed to fix a boundary condition that's constraining the space of fields. Like that's sort of like what you're always told, like you pick Neumann or Dirichlet or something like that. And then I'm kind of telling you our expectation is from something like that, we want to find this factorization P0 algebra on the boundary and this kind of Lagrangian map. That's sort of our expectation. So what I'm going to now tell you is basically the construction I presented last time is just realizing that. It's just realizing that expectation in a constructive way.
So everything here is sort of topological in one direction.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's just a bunch of stuff that you can say about more general.
Yes, it's just that this notion of finding the kind of analog of the factorization P1 thing over N is a lot subtler in a more general setup because you have to kind of figure out how many, like sort of what order germs of solutions you kind of want to keep track of, and it depends on the kind of order of the differential equations and stuff. So there's a kind of more standard physics story about kind of finding this variational one form. It's kind of an n minus one form valued in one forms on the fields and kind of building a two form out of it. Like if you look in the IAS volumes and you look at like Dalene Fried's classical field theory stuff, they'll kind of do this. And they find like this is all really canonical if you have a first order Lagrangian, which is pretty closely related to sort of being topological normal to the boundary, first order in time. But it sort of becomes kind of a mess and things aren't really that canonical in the kind of general case. And that's sort of, that's the kind of issue we're having.
What if you are holomorphic in one complex direction relative to, I guess in that case it's not a boundary, it's like a codimension, or it's like a complex boundary or something. Can you say?
I can, but I'd rather not right now.
Yeah.
So I'm going to just now write a definition. So let's assume we're in exactly this setting that I have on this top board. So definition is that A, there's some kind of adjective here like regular embedded, which is related to kind of having this deformation to the normal cone thing be true. Boundary condition for E is a Lagrangian subbundle L including into E del, so subvector bundle over N, which was the boundary of N. So this was a definition that I think I stated a little too quickly last time. And there was a remark which I really should have made and I forgot to, which is this looks like a very bad notion of boundary condition. Can maybe someone tell me why?
Locality.
Sort of naively? Well, it's sort of pretty local. It's like a subbundle. It's sort of, if anything, what I want to say is it's too restrictive. It's not that it's not restrictive enough, but there's something about this that naively seems like sort of too restrictive. Okay, I'll just sort of say, so restricting the fields to just live in a subbundle, somehow it's basically just like only ever considering Dirichlet. That's what it seems like, right? Is Dirichlet the right one?
Yeah.
Right?
You're not adding boundary degrees of freedom.
So this regular embedded thing is something about no boundary degrees of freedom, but also there's no constraints on derivatives. I didn't say anything about normal. I'm sort of saying, oh, I'm just picking some subbundle of the boundary vector bundle, and I'm just telling you it should live in there.
But
so this seems like
this E del also contains anti-fields.
Exactly. So the thing is that in this sort of first order BV formalism, some of these guys, they're sort of equations of motion that are imposing that they're identified with like normal derivatives of geometric fields, and that's why this sort of isn't totally stupid. But if you weren't in the BV formalism, this would look like a pretty silly definition. And these kinds of things about that I was just saying about how many germs of the solutions to equations of motion you're kind of trying to keep track of, they sort of like, but this is like, we're in a really simple situation, and so we have a kind of good definition.
Is this solved because it's topological? Like,
sure.
Isn't that this works because you're topological?
Yeah, that's right. But even if you presented a topological field theory in sort of a different formalism or something, there might still, let me not go into the details of that. I think it's not the right thing to talk about.
But
To
that point, can I ask, like,
sure,
is it sort of like formally topological or something?
I'm not sure I understand.
I mean, like, you take some formal neighborhood of your boundary and like cut it in that formal direction. Like,
yeah. I mean, I'm making a stronger assumption. It's really just topological. I mean, this is all kind of classical too, but. Okay, so now I'm going to remind you of the construction I presented last time, which I know is probably kind of a lot, but the main point is from this data, I want to tell you how to get this part. I sort of told you like from that data you get this part, and now I'm telling you from this data you're going to get this part. And that's what the construction I presented last time is. So the basic answer of how we're going to get it is we're just going to assign to each U that's an open subset of N, we're going to assign functions on the sections of L over U. So these are just like the fields that survive at the boundary, sort of along this open set in the boundary. So this part is very analogous to sort of the usual setup. So that's great. This is going to define kind of a commutative factorization algebra in sort of a trivial way. But I now kind of have to tell you how to get a P0 structure. That's the data I need to explain.
What question are you answering?
Right. I literally just said it before, but it is how to construct, given something satisfying this definition, this expectation.
Okay.
And the underlying commutative factorization algebra, so this is sort of going to be a factorization P0 algebra over N, but I need to tell you how to get the P0 structure. And I'm just going to squeeze it in down here because it's sort of detailed and it's not that fun, and then we'll take a vote on how much we want to talk about it, and then we'll see what we do in the last 20 minutes. So the main point, so we're looking for a minus one shifted plus on bracket, and to tell you carefully what that is, it's an element of the space of what are called minus one shifted polyvector fields, but it's a comal sort of on L, but it's a cohomological degree one element. Now let me tell you what this is. By definition, the space of minus one shifted polyvector fields is the space of functions on T star L. So I would just point out usual polyvector fields with their usual grading by sort of polyvector field degree are functions on T shifted by one L. And you can just define in general some kind of shifted polyvector fields of whatever shifts. Yes? Yes, that's right. Sort of one, that's right. So we want to find this guy. That's what we're looking for. So it would be good if we had something here. And the sort of point is, like this is sort of a space of functions. So we're basically looking for some function in this space of functions of cohomological degree plus one. And the answer, so how do we do this? The main point was that E del, because L is Lagrangian and something zero shifted, E del looks a lot like T star L. You have a Lagrangian, it sort of almost looks like the cotangent bundle of the Lagrangian, your ambient symplectic thing, especially because we're sort of technically in kind of formal geometry, so things like this are kind of really close to being true. But you need to deform this guy by a kind of cohomological degree plus one vector field, Q. And that cohomological degree plus one vector field, it preserves the symplectic structure, so it's Hamiltonian, sort of for reasons Phil explained. And so it's given by Poisson bracketing with S, where S is a function, but it has to be degree plus one so that we get a degree plus one vector. And that's how we find this S and correspondingly this phi. And this sort of pair, T star L, with whatever differentials it was going to have, together with this sort of extra differential Q, this is what we define as the cotangent bundle to L deformed by the Poisson structure pi.
Sorry, what does S mean to satisfy?
Pardon me?
What does S mean to satisfy?
Right, so S, this needs to kind of be square zero. So what we need is really like, there's some internal differential here, which maybe also has a Hamiltonian, and we need like kind of S original plus S to satisfy the classical master equation, so that this guy is sort of really a well-defined space. And this condition, it sort of turns out, is equivalent to pi being Poisson. Basically because like the Poisson bracket on functions on T star, when you expand it in terms of polyvector fields, it's like the Skouten bracket. So this usual kind of pi bracket pi condition looks a lot like this S bracket S condition. That's kind of what's going on. And then really there's a whole bunch of, like, all the terms that aren't a bivector are some kind of homotopy coherence data, and I don't really want to go into that, but that's the gist of it.
What was S4 again?
Pardon me?
S4.
It's sort of whatever the sort of Hamiltonian for the original cohomological vector field is on T star L.
Okay.
It's OR is for original. Sorry. Yeah.
It's like you're restricting to the boundary and that's...
Yeah.
That's...
Yeah, that's sort of the... Yeah. Well, on T star L, not on E del.
Oh, T star.
Somehow the point is, like, you have some boundary action, and it has this extra term that isn't just coming from T star L, and that extra term is sort of what you want.
So SL comes from the poly.
SL. Yeah, I mean, E del is determined by the bulk, and it will look like T star of the Lagrangian you chose up to some correction. So now, yeah, maybe this is a good time for me to sort of spell out this, the following sort of, oh man, I've broken so many chalks. The following thing, which I think is really useful. So the way I've been explaining this, the way you should think about it, we chose E and E del. That was our input data. And we chose L. So sort of E, and then sort of, which implies E del, together with L, we took this data as our sort of input, and our output was pi. And that was the construction we presented. And that was the way in which I realized our goal here of taking something satisfying that definition and producing the x vector. But it's worth pointing out that there's this sort of equality also tells you that if you take L and pi, from that you can construct T star pi L, which is E del. And then you can also construct E by just taking forms box E del. So what you learn is that this process is actually reversible, and it tells you basically for every field theory, it could have been an honest symplectic field theory, or it could have been one of these sort of slightly funnier Poisson guys, there's some kind of canonical theory, one dimension higher, which gives this theory as its boundary. And it kind of has a canonical boundary condition too, coming from like L including in L. And this, we use the word sort of universal bulk theory. And I'll say more about this maybe in a minute. I just wanted to mention it now. It seemed like a good time because we were asking about what determines what here. And right, I just wanted to comment sort of for people on the more sort of in the know side, this is like basically the derived Poisson center. And it's just the kind of the P0 version of Hochschild Perchains. Of Hochschild cochains.
No, I mean, it's the Poisson center of what?
Of L. So L pi determines this thing, and the name for it is it's the Poisson center. Okay. Yeah.
So suppose that bivector theory is not topological at all. Under which condition will the bivector theory be topological?
Be completely topological?
This is what happens relatively often.
Right. So if the boundary theory was honestly degenerate, then that would not happen that often. But whenever the boundary theory is an honest symplectic theory, the type of thing that comes from a Lagrangian, then sort of no matter how interesting it looks, this sort of relative theory that it's the theory that it's kind of relative to has to be topological. So it's very often topological.
Like maybe probably topological.
Yeah, but it's important that it's sort of topological in the way that the A model is topological. That's really what's kind of happening. And I'll maybe comment if I have time that it's sort of this procedure is sort of supposed to be related to this kind of new look at the path integral kind of perspective. And there it's always sort of an A model type, maybe twist of a supersymmetric theory if you're in the higher dimensional examples, or in the kind of just classical example, it's an A model in the bulk. And it's kind of A model type topological that occurs.
Are you going to give examples of universal bulk theories?
Yeah, sure, I could. So that's a great segue for me to ask people. We're gonna have a vote. So we can do two things. We can just do kind of crazy fun stuff and I don't explain calculations. Or we could sort of try to revisit a little bit about the calculations I did last time and kind of understand sort of how this really works and some examples and how you really get these pies. And that the kind of more fun stuff involves some kind of interval compactifications and maybe like brain constructions and maybe this new look at the path integral. And the less fun stuff is like the calculations I claimed last time and maybe this seeing the WZW model.
Well, I changed my vote in that case. I want to new look at the path integral.
I mean, I'm not going to have that much interesting to say about it. I don't want to like, it's just going to be some kind of inspiring pictures, but I think it'll be nice too. So what do people think? I don't know. You just shout it out.
Pictures,
all right. You got one for pictures. WZW, oh.
Fun stuff.
What do you think, Peter? Fun stuff.
Fun stuff.
All right, fun stuff, all right. Nice, that's what I wanted, guys. Okay, fun stuff. No more calculations, that's great. Okay, great. So this is all you're ever gonna learn about this, whatever. Okay. That's fine. Let's start doing some fun stuff. So the next thing I want to talk about is interval compactification. And this has come up in a whole bunch of talks, but I think we're in a really good position to explain how some interval compactification calculations go. So actually maybe, just before I do this, I'll just draw a quick picture here. So let's remember we had our whole kind of expectation chart here. And we're really interested just in this topological normal to the boundary situation. So we've just cut off anything more general than that. These are our kind of quantum and classical expectations. And now what I want to tell you is what happens if you have kind of two boundary conditions and a bulk theory. So in this kind of simple E1 setting, like what you expect is that you have an algebra assigned to the bulk, and you kind of have two modules, M1 and M2. And what I want to tell you is that if you want to understand, and our theory is topological in this direction, so it's sort of independent of the length scale. You can imagine sort of stretching it or shrinking it. And in particular, if you shrink it really, really small, let me make things higher dimensional so it's a little more interesting. I've got some little Riemann surface here, my topological direction, some other Riemann surface. So we shrink it, this interval, really, really small, and it effectively looks like a theory just on a single Riemann surface. And so the question is, what is this theory? And so if we had sort of sort of factorization E1 algebra, and we have two kind of modules for it, M1 and M2, the answer for what we assign to this is we take the tensor product of these modules over this algebra. And this is an element just of factorization algebras over M, factorization E0. So this is kind of our expectation for how to put two boundary conditions and squish them together along the interval and produce a new theory. In the classical setting, we know that what we're really going to have is two Lagrangians. We're going to have some kind of, you know, E del E del, so we're gonna have two Lagrangians mapping to it, and we wanna take their fiber product. If I could elaborate this a bit more, I just wanna point out that this fiber product can also be expanded in this way, where E is sort of the bulk field along the strip.
Are you using the topological moment of the boundary assumption to
expand? I am.
Like
yeah, everything is topological moment of the boundary. I erase this column, we're just in this setting. For the rest of the talk, that's it. Okay, so what's going on here? Why did I want to rewrite this like this? Let me draw this sort of picture in the classical setting. So we have our bulk theory, which sort of looks like forms on this interval 0, 1, sort of box this E del, and it has two restriction to the boundary maps, where we basically pull back in the sort of forms component to either 0 or 1. That's restricting the fields. And then we have these two Lagrangians, kind of L1 and L2, coming in here. And so this fiber product, just by definition, is just bulk solutions to the equations of motion, such that if you restrict them to the boundary at one side, they satisfy boundary condition L2, and similarly at the other side, L1. So this is sort of physically obviously the right thing you want. And then if you notice that sort of this forms on the interval is contractible, and these are both kind of equivalences, then you can just sort of identify this fiber product with this simpler one, which is what we expect just passing to the classical analog of that. So we sort of learned that we want to compute intersections of Lagrangians in the phase space, and now you'll remember I told you this great result, that if you have something zero shifted downstairs, then the whole thing, this whole intersection of two Lagrangians and something zero shifted is minus one shift. So we indeed expect to find a P0 factorization algebra, which moreover is actually kind of symplectic. It's more like a full field theory as the result of this calculation. Okay. So let's do a concrete example. So I kind of talked last time a bit about the B model, but I'll just remind you. So this is literally in the dimensions sort of pictured here. You have the B model, which is kind of built out of maps from this closed interval times R to T star shifted by 1. Sorry? You were asking why I didn't write Duram here? I think, please stop asking me questions like that. Anyway, so E del is, of course, maps just from Duram. So I should start with X. And so one obvious choice of boundary condition, which corresponds, I think, to like the structure sheaf, if you want to think of boundary conditions as quasi-Cartesian sheaves, is just maps from R to ROM to X. And now, when we compute this fiber product, let's just take for now, say, L with itself. We find maps from R to ROM to the fiber product of X with itself over T star 1x, which is just T star X. I.e., we find topological mechanics to the cotangent bundle of X. And I mean, I'm not really good. I know a lot about twists of Suzy theories, but not a lot about supersymmetric quantum mechanics, surprisingly. But I assume like what's going on here is something analogous to what we've been told, that if you take a kind of pair of boundary conditions for a 2-2 a 2-2 sigma model, and you slap compactify, that you can kind of find some, which it should be n equals 2 supersymmetric quantum mechanics as a result. And I assume this is some kind of appropriate twist here. I mean, I know this is a twist of 2-2, so. Anyway. So this somehow was like a bit formal, but let me tell you like one slightly more interesting example. We could have chosen separately L, a different Lagrangian kind of L tilde or whatever. So what does like a typical Lagrangian in a cotangent bundle or shifted cotangent bundle look like? Well, it looks like maps to the graph of a closed one form. Sort of the graph of a one form is like a good half-dimensional thing, and the closeness of the one form turns out to be Lagrangian. And let me write my closed one form. Let's just assume it's exact, so then it'll be closed. Let's call it DW. Then, when we compute this fiber product, L fiber product L tilde over E del, we find mechanics to a kind of funny shifted version so that this ends up being zero shifted of the critical locus of W. And this is sort of, should be some twist, presumably is a twist, of super quantum mechanics with a super potential W.
Like this L is like they're supposed to form a category in this 2D sigma model.
The space of L's.
Yeah.
That's right.
And are you computing here? Like this calculation you did here was like Hom from L to itself? In that
That's
category?
Right. I computed the self X, which we learned is supposed to be the algebra of local operators.
Yeah, I'm just a little bit from that, which is not trivial.
Yeah, so I mean.
Say, the both way of getting Neumann and Neumann, for example, in a section of O. This is density, so no, right? It's basically states you're quantizing O, so you're quantizing the manifold, so you're gonna get densities. You have to quantize something at some point, right? Like, I would have guessed.
Yeah.
Well, I would have guessed that here you have T star X and you're supposed to quantize that to take, yeah, you get like a polarization and quantize it like L2 of X or something. Or
exactly.
Like all Hartree functions on it.
Mm-hmm.
So those are sections of square root of the canonical bundle. Oh, so that's not the same thing as like global functions. But this is half a set of functors, notation by pi.
And that's what you're saying about this up to state operator, this serif operator, yeah.
One of those questions you asked is not just asking. So why the T naught?
Yeah, definitely one of those. Yeah. They're supposed to be, if you want. Any other questions?
Is DW going to.
So DW. Right, so we're trying to find a Lagrangian in a cotangent bundle. So the graph of a one form is a great half dimensional submanifold of a cotangent bundle, and the closeness of the one form turns out to be equivalent to Lagrangian, as I said. So in particular, if it's exact, that's going to be a good example.
So which kind of plane is it? Is it just a plane localized on the critical points of value? Assume. It's like for the critical point of value.
So you kind of would tell us, like, if we want to think of it as a quasi-coherent sheaf, we should sort of Hom into it fiber by fiber.
Yes.
Right? So if we do that, let's see. So we intersect a fiber with a W. Does someone want to help me out here?
Why quasi-coherent sheaf does this correspond to graph of the W? I mean, it's clearly a rank one vector bundle, right? Because at every point, your fiber is just hitting like the graph of one point.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah.
So
it's probably like,
is it just also the structure sheet?
No, it can't be that. It's something should.
I think there is a differential. I think it's gonna be supported. It's like a complex of like the structure sheet is mapped into itself by W or something. By DW.
Yeah, I'm not.
I think it's a kind of solution of the critical point.
Critical locus of W.
then if it was W was zero, then you would get the original
thing. Yeah,
the
next plus X.
And it would give OX? Yeah, so in the case when W is zero, we concluded we should get OX.
Suppose you put Dirichlet, okay, what's this phase space now?
Suppose I put Dirichlet against it, you mean. Then what's the phase space of the quantum mechanics? I mean, the intersection is of expected dimension, so there's no derived stuff. So it's a point.
Point.
Yeah.
Actually, so if you quantize this L times L, or quantize L times L tilde, you get different answers, so you get the same answer.
If you quantize L times L, it seems like I think we agreed you should get sections of OX.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not even sure this thing is going to make sense right away. There's going to be an integrality condition, right? Like just like when you're doing ordinary geometric quantization, like you can't quant, like there, you need like a your symplectic form to be integral, right? So you can actually have a line bundle.
Every single value is not the line bundle, I think it's a trivial. I'm just wondering if somehow you're defining the same actually the same one like condition. If this is a deal, isn't it just an example formation on L? So that is equivalent in some way.
Yeah, sorry, I should have been better prepared for this. I propose maybe that I just say two more minutes worth of stuff, draw some inspiring pictures, we conclude, and then maybe those of us interested can kind of discuss this. We should be able to sort it out. So the last thing I kind of want to advertise that you can do with this kind of formalism, I sort of emphasize this case of just having a module here, where you kind of just have a boundary condition, so you have a left or right module. But of course, if the theory kind of continued over here, you would have also expected to have some other algebra acting on this, and this would sort of be a bimodule.
So like I think like the thing is that right, this thing is supposed to be like a one-shifted one form on X.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's supposed to be like a one-one, like a form of like type 1-1.
Uh-huh.
And like such a thing could be like the curvature, like the Kähler form for a line bundle, like if and only if it's like integral. And like if it were integral,
it would
like
be sections.
It would be quantizable and it would be that line bundle.
Sections of the line bundle. Okay. Yeah, that sounds like a good.
But like that's the way it's supposed to work. But like just like in ordinary like quantum mechanics, like you don't expect to have a state for every Lagrangian and phase space. There's like the Bohr-Sommerfeld condition. There's sort of like a derived Bohr-Sommerfeld condition you have to check before you know that you'll get a line bundle. And it's basically that this one-one form needs to be like in, you know, integral.
It might not make sense quantum mechanically.
Great, okay, so yeah, don't worry, I'm not going anywhere, unlike last time. So the last thing I wanted to say, so I was just mentioning, I'll kind of repeat, that in this case where the theory kind of extends on both sides of this sort of codimension one defect, you expect it to, rather than just being a module, to be a sort of bimodule. So now there's this thing called string theory, which of course isn't the topic of this conference. But people in physics draw these kind of pictures where the idea is that you're kind of picturing that these are all some kind of high dimensional submanifolds of some big manifold that your string theory lives in. They're called brains. Maybe they have some labels, whatever. And that if you zoom in really, really close on sort of a stack of them, let's say sort of there's some directions that I'm kind of suppressing here. Let's say the point in here is like, say, a Riemann surface or whatever, kind of like secretly suppressed. So if you zoom in really, really close along here, there's sort of this direction times the Riemann surface going on. And kind of generically here, you'll find some kind of gauge theory, which maybe has the rank of the gauge group related to kind of the number of the lines here. About GL3 gauge theory, but in particular, whatever it is, we expect it to define some kind of factorization algebra along this kind of component. And then coming from a kind of picture like this, where these brains end on this other brain, you expect to get a sort of boundary condition for this gauge theory as a result. So similarly, zooming in here, we expect to find kind of GL2 gauge theory because there's sort of 1, 2 here. And then from this piece here, we find some codimension 1 defect, which we've learned to parse as factorization by module over the sort of relevant factorization E1 algebras here and here. And sort of so on for the rest of this. And so one of the main important applications of string theory is to kind of do constructions in quantum field theory. So the sort of narrative is that you kind of take a certain scaling limit where you zoom out a lot and these guys all kind of come together. I mean, I don't really know what happens here, but maybe everything just collapses to a point here because I've suppressed the Riemann surface direction at sort of this little point. And down here, we're just doing this thing that we sort of learned to do here, where we have these kind of, you know, A, B, and C, and we have these kind of modules and bimodules. And we learned that we should kind of expect to find this factorization algebra given by this kind of iterated tensor product. In factorization algebras on sort of n, where n is kind of this, whatever this direction along here, this kind of as pictured as a Riemann surface. And the kind of main output that you learn is that somehow the geometry of this, it determines the kind of structure, the kind of composition structure of your tensor product, and it determines sort of what this resulting field theory looks like. And this particular example, the kind of thing it tells you is that you, so from this picture, I'm going to tell you you can draw a quiver with labels 3, 2, 4, where these were the, you know, the dimensions of the ranks of the gauge groups down here and the kind of number of these lines. And you know, we could have also maybe had like sort of some extra stuff coming off here, which would have kind of made this guy more colored and changed M1. And maybe I could have added to this quiver sort of, let's say this was whatever, 6. I could have added a sort of aux 6, whatever this means. And you know, from this quiver, you can read off something like a Nakajima quiver variety, which is some kind of symplectic space, and out of it you can build some field theory in an AKZ type way, say, or some kind of supersymmetric field theory that's related to this quiver variety. And the statement is basically that you expect that such things can be built out of kind of iterated tensor products of these sort of factorization modules and bimodules, and it's all kind of predicted from pictures like this. And you can kind of really, if you can sort of at least read the string theory literature at the level of narrative, you can really try to kind of write these things down using the descriptions of twists that we understand and really kind of compute this stuff, and it becomes a real thing. And in the kind of dimensions like sort of 2, 3, 4, where there are links to a lot of like really well understood math and things like 4dn equals 4, 3dn equals 4, 2dn equals 2, 2, or 4, 4, this leads to sort of like a whole sea of different kind of cool conjectures coming from sort of dualities in string theory and like various constructions of this type. There are like lots of different bells and whistles you could add on, like lines in every other direction that sort of modify this picture in any number of ways. But it's really led to like a lot of cool kind of conjectures about connections between different areas of pure math, of the types of things that I think people here are really interested in. And hopefully Justin will kind of follow up and sort of explain some really cool stuff if you ever stop doing supersymmetry algebra calculations, and tell you about like geometric Langlands and deflected duality and that kind of thing. And you can really predict like a lot of the structure there just from some kind of string theory narrative in this sort of way. Anyway, so I'm gonna stop there. Thanks. Oh, yeah, of course.
So you had this notion of a universal bulk theory, and sort of the, maybe not canonical, but a really important example from physics is this ABS-CFT correspondence. Might you expect to attack such a problem mathematically? It's certainly not exactly in this framework, but there's lots of flavor similar to what one sees there.
It's a common misconception that the gauge theory in the SFT lives at the boundary of the gauge.
Yes.
The gauge theory is equivalent to the gauge theory at the boundary.
Yes.
It's not like that. What you're saying is still true, but it's not a dwarf.
Yes.
Yeah, I have no feedback. My feedback is only a strict subset of whatever Jeffrey has to say about it.
Can you explain this point that you made, that if the boundary theory is Lagrangian, then the universal bulk theory will look A-modeling?
Rather, if it's symplectic, you mean? If the boundary theory is symplectic.
If it's like an honest Lagrangian classical field theory, which I guess...
Oh, Lagrangian in that sense. Sorry. Yeah, there's always this dual Lagrangian confusion. Yes, I can, and luckily I've left this on the board. So what we're considering is, what does this Poisson center look like in the case when pi is symplectic? What does this deformation look like? And the basic point... So what does it look like? I mean, who knows? So we've got T star L, and we want to deform it. And we know that L in this case is going to have a -1 shifted Poisson structure. So that tells me, if I use that -1 shifted Poisson structure omega, or maybe I use pi omega, I can make this isomorphic to the cotangent bundle with some shift, or rather the tangent bundle with some shift. And does someone want to tell me what shift I'm going to get here? It's -1 shifted. So if it was going the other way, it would be -1. So this is probably +1. And now we're asking about a deformation of this. But I can kind of like pat, which is just literally coming from pi. But I can sort of ask, oh, well, what does this deformation look like sort of under this kind of conjugated by just this isomorphism pi? So there's some deformation here of t shifted by 1L. And somehow this Poisson bracket with pi, once we use this pi isomorphism, it kind of just becomes the identity map. So the tangent complex of this of course looks like the tangent complex to L, and another copy in degree -1. And the deformation is going to just look like the identity map under this. But this is, of course, what the tangent complex to the Durham stack looks like. The answer is that we deform to the Durham stack in this case. And somehow, you know, field theories whose target, so then if we make this replacement, so once we get T star pi, what do? We add like maps in a normal direction on and whatever, but ultimately if we have this kind of Durham stack in the target, your theory sort of looks A-mod. Sort of what I mean by A-mod.
How does this relate to a new look at the path integral?
That's a good question. So one example, this is great, I just get to talk about everything. Please feel free to leave. So one example of this correspondence is if you take L to be Chern-Simons theory. So this is, of course, symplectic, and so it fits into this kind of situation I was describing here that, Surya just asked about. So if we take T star L, we're going to get forms on R3 tensor. Is someone going to help me here? So it's going to be G, semi-direct, woo, so much broken chalk. G dual. Do you think anyone can tell me the shift? I can just figure it out. Hold on. That should be a fine shift. It's two. One? Does that look good?
Sure.
It's minus one.
Let's see. So this is supposed to be symplectic. This looks like. Is it right? Is that right? I think it's right.
It's okay. Nobody's.
So this is supposed to be. This is supposed to be whatever this is. It should be the tangent complex. It should be the, minus one shifted tangent complex to T star three of BG. I think I got it right. Anyway, so then what's our prescription? For one, we need to kind of deform by this pi, and what that's gonna do, I mean, yeah, okay, so now I know I'm right. So G is basically the same as G dual under this trace pairing, which is sort of related to the, you know, the pairing on the transimons and also the pairing on BG, this two-shifted pairing. And so it kind of just gives basically a differential that goes like this, which is kind of just a baseline. Or it's equivalent to sort of the two-shifted structure on BG. If we just do a shifted version of the construction I explained, the two-shifted structure on BG knows how to deform the three-shifted cotangent. So this guy kind of, hi. And so as a result, if we kind of take maps, or to ROM, to, so this is our E del, we find sort of maps from a four manifold to T star three BG deformed by the Poisson structure here. And this is the generic. And this part I'm a little bit confused about, to be totally honest. The generic Kapustin-Wynn twist for DN equals. So for one, this is exactly sort of supposed to be one of the settings that this new look at the path integral perspective applies to. I could have done sort of a simpler version where you basically just replace the copy of loc g sitting inside of here of a surface with any symplectic space, and it kind of would have all reduced to like a quantum mechanics to that symplectic space and like a mixed AB model in the bulk would be equivalent to what I just said. Or like a generalization, and then if you just kind of plug in loc g of the surface, it's this example. or loc g, flat g, I don't know if you have strong opinions about that ever. And now this, the way the story is supposed to go is that there's sort of a slight catch, which is really here you would have got the complex group in Kapustin-Witten. And so technically what you actually find is complexified transimons at the boundary. But kind of complexified transimons, you don't quite know how to do your path integral. And this, the idea is that somehow you're supposed to find a path integral contour using some kind of gradient descent. So from the perspective I've been explaining, we have this kind of Chern-Simons theory at the boundary, or whatever kind of super quantum mechanics at the boundary, and we have this bulk sort of A-model-y type theory. And somehow what you should always expect is that kind of, even though this was in principle kind of a symplectic theory to begin with, we have this kind of complexification subtlety. But the general expectation, as I explained, is that boundary theories might just be Poisson. But after slab compactifying, that's when you really find the thing that's sort of supposed to be meaningful and calculatable. It's like minus one symplectic and kind of would only have a one-dimensional space of conformal blocks and gives numbers. So what you should expect is that you should have to choose some kind of boundary condition at infinity. And what this sort of new look at the path integral story, I sort of hope, is kind of the way it's being manifested here in this kind of BV formalism, is that if you choose kind of topological boundary conditions at infinity and compute the slab compactification, you find some results on three-dimensional theories, and those are sort of supposed to be just effectively Chern-Simons theory in the presence of sort of a modified path integral contour. And it's sort of different choices, so choice of this BC infinity determines this path integral contour for the boundary theory at zero. This is infinity here. And then there's this story that somehow, if you actually kind of properly calculated this sort of before passing to the twist, the bulk equations of motion here are telling you something about sort of gradient flowing, whatever kind of Lagrangian you chose here, sort of along these equations of motion, and somehow by the time you get here, it's supposed to be your like kind of correct path integral contour.
Sorry, I missed a couple of steps. So,
what was the shape of the four manifold where you're picking the boundary condition at infinity?
Pardon me?
What's the four manifold you're looking at? So you're doing like Chern-Simons on some three manifold, but you want to have an option to put things at infinity.
Yeah, so I just took R plus.
Oh, R plus. Any other questions?
But somehow like a boundary condition could also be determined if you had sort of like a little bit of a Kohler neighborhood and then a funky manifold at the end, then the equations of motion from that
would be like kind of
would also determine sort of a non-local boundary condition, which.
You just cross within intervals.
I mean, there's somehow this idea that it's like there's some kind of asymptotic kind of flow thing going on. I don't know. You know, people draw these sort of like Lefschetz symbol pictures and how to. To this? Ah, right. Well, so somehow there's like this boundary condition might have been determined by like a Lagrangian in the target of the mapping stack. And you're somehow imagining that like if you tried to kind of solve the equations of motion or like integrate out the fields kind of along here to sort of slowly find out as you got closer and closer to zero, sort of what boundary condition you were sort of compactifying against, that somehow that's like sort of flowing the Lagrangian. That's interesting.
Isn't this exactly the analytic continuation of Chern-Simons embodiment?
Yeah, this is supposed to be exactly. That's what I'm sort of alleging to reproduce, but I don't claim to understand sort of all the details. But that is exactly what I'm trying to do. Yeah, I should like write in big letters like Witten or whatever, like everywhere. I mean, like this, yeah, there wasn't any like, other than maybe a few points about the mathematical formalism, there's not pretense of originality here. It's, yeah, just trying to teach.
When you say generic, you mean that the twist is generic in some sense?
Yeah, so there's a P1 worth of twist of 14 equals 4, and there's kind of some particular like B1 and particular A1, where the particular B1 is sort of like maybe like that, and the particular A1 maybe it's sort of, you have the pi, but it's kind of more holomorphic and there's more cotangent directions. But really matching exactly what Kapustin and Witten did is a bit of a tricky business. And I think in a way, like the sort of state of the art in exactly how field theory is matching geometric Langlands is still kind of under revision.
Okay. So would it be a sensible thing to say terminologically back in this Quiver gauge theory story that the Quiver gauge theory is this tensor?
Yeah, this is the Quiver gauge theory. That's the term. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you nailed it. Anyway, we better let people go, so let's I'm calling it the end, but we can...